Hello everyone, it's just me this time around. I'm just going to do a bit of an introduction slash go over the entire Necromancer thing, because we've had a really big End Times book and there's a lot of iffy stuff about it, so I just thought I'd clarify as much as I can. So I'm just doing this on myself to try and keep it as quick as possible, really, without too much diversions. So, it's all about Nagash, really, and the End of Times, because he's coming back, which is terrible and good, I suppose, depending on which way you look at it. But it does give us an interesting set of rules, so I'll just start by going over the history of Nagash. For those of you who don't know, it's just a brief summary. So he was the first son of the ruler of Khemri at the time. He joined a cult dedicated to the prolonging of life. There were some dark elves that were defeated by high elves and washed up on the shores of where they lived. And basically he tortured this dark necromancer that told him everything about dark magic, which is really stupid to start with. So you've got a couple of stupid points before it even gets going. Upon his father's death, he betrays his brother to become the king. He uses an undead army of slaves, pretty much, to build his Black Pyramid of Nagash. The nearby kings revolt and form an alliance to defeat him with a massive legion that battle a horde of skeletons to remove him from the throne. But he does actually lose and he flees. He runs into some Skaven and he's nearly dead, and he actually kills them miraculously, takes a warp stone and manages to use it to maintain himself, and develops a minor warpstone addiction. But then he finds Triple Peaks, where he discovers a massive warpstone deposit, and that's where he builds his giant fortress, which is called Nagashizar, I think. I might not be saying this right, it's been ages since I've read the Undead book. But his prolonged exposure to warpstone and use of warpstone turns him into a giant skeleton. Go figure, I don't remember any giant grey seers walking around, but hey, maybe that's what happened to the Horned One. Nagash faces off with the Skaven when they realise that the fortress is basically full of warpstone, and they fight a pretty prolonged war, which neither side actually wins. In the end, there's a compromise made, and in exchange for lulling victims into a death trap, the Skaven get paid in warpstone, which, as everyone knows, I'm pretty sure you'd agree that that would be pretty acceptable terms for them. Meanwhile, back in the Land of the Dead, well, soon to be Land of the Dead, Queen Neferata studies some books that Nagash had and learns a pretty gruesome array of things, let's just put it that way, and she creates the vampires and starts her own little uprising. She is eventually defeated by the same guy who defeated Nagash, I believe, and they all flee, and there's only six master vampires left. So there's her, six master vampires flee to Nagash at Nagashizar / Triple Peak. Nagash decides to try and take it on himself with his newfound allies, the vampires, to try and rid themselves again of these guys that are really opposing his rule. So they march on them again, and they're defeated again, but this time it's generally pasted that they're defeated because the vampires decide to turn tail and run. So Nagash curses them so that the sunlight will always burn them. So there's a bit of a thing, because light magic does a hell of a lot more damage to undead and demons, but it's a bit iffy as to why it does that. I suppose fluff-wise they're kind of making out it's Nagash, and this is all of his big bolt to power, I am a demigod thing. So it kind of ties in with that. But anyway, back to his history. Once he realises that he's never going to be able to take it by force, he pays off some more Skaven to infiltrate and corrupt the water supply so he can kill off most of the defenders. And once he does, he attacks again, and with everyone dead and dying, he can easily convert them and raise an unstoppable army. And the guy who was stopping him, Al-Kadizar, or whatever he's called, is captured, thrown in a cell to be tortured by Nagash. As I understand it, he's tortured several times, and eventually this is why he's a bit hateful. So Nagash is just trying to be pissy because he defeated him a couple of times, but in doing so he really riles this guy up. He then lets slip what his plan is, to basically raise a massive army to conquer the entire world by killing and raising just about everyone within a couple of hundred miles. this is the first time that the Skaven ever unanimously vote to do anything, and it's to assassinate Nagash, the Forge of Fellblade. They have some Eshin operatives infiltrate and free Al-Kadizar, or whatever it's called. They give him the blade, basically open the door, and they go, there you go. And he basically catches Nagash just after he's done his massive resurrection spell to try and lay his legions and legions of undead. But because of his weakened state, he catches Nagash off guard and basically hacks him into bits. But his hand manages to get away. The Skaven do a pretty good job of trying to stop him from coming back by capturing the rest of his bits and burning them all in Warpstone, so they should in theory be gone. But without the hand, he manages to go back to his Black Temple and reconstitute himself as the undead. Anyway, that's the brief history as I understand it from the Nagash point of view. There is a little bit of a resurrection point where he basically tries to get his magical items back and runs into Sigmar's fist and gets his skull smashed in with a hammer. And that's it, he dies and rises again. Ironically, the Tomb Kings only exist because of Nagash. And a big thing of the new book is bringing the Tomb Kings and the vampires together to be used as one force. But there's some really dubious wording when you read the books, especially in the fluff side. He defeats the King of the Tomb Kings and takes possession of all the armies, but the very last page of the book, at the End Times, is him there smited and defeated by Nagash, and a voice ominously talking to him about regaining his former power. So I don't really know what's planned for the next thing, or whether that's just their redcon pre-placement, just in case this all goes epic tits up, we'll just roll everything back to before anything happened. So that's the rough history of it. So that brings us to the actual pack. Nagash the End Times is a £50 Warhammer supplement. You can probably get it cheaper if you look online, actually, to be honest, I'd advise it. You can order it direct from Games Workshop, and here's a nice little catch-22 which really feckin' irritated me. Any order with Games Workshop of £50 or more is free delivery. And it does state that you should receive your delivery within 24 hours. However, free delivery is not next day delivery. So really, there's some dubious wording, and I actually ordered it from GW and then cancelled it because, for one, I could get it cheaper from an independent retailer and support a local business, so I decided to do that instead. And two, they basically wanted to try and blackmail me into having next day delivery and an extra £5. And I thought, fuck that for a lark. So you get two really high quality books. You can't complain about the books. There is a lot of information in there. I would say it's more for people who like to read fluff. Yeah, I think the main thing is for me is they've took a really half-assed approach to the actual army list and the army list selections, which I'll get onto in a bit. I don't want to sway too much. But yeah, you get two really nice books and a little Nagash notebook, which I thought was a nice touch. I kind of don't understand why you don't get the magic cards with the book. You know, I mean, yeah, there's a page with all the magic on, but you don't get the cards. And you can't have one without the other, especially with this, because it's all summoning stuff. So you need the book anyway. So why they've released them as separate entities, I don't know. They should have just stuck an extra tenner on the package price and included the magical cards, because they all sold out anyway, because they've not limited how many that anyone could buy, so a lot of people mass sold and then mass resold to get whatever they want, 20, 30 quid on eBay. So, yes. The first book, I'd say, from a gaming perspective, you don't really need to read. It's just stuff that happened. It's a good read. It's interesting. I have issue with some of it. I have big issue with some of it. It's basically the stories of what's happening and how the armies are coping and what's going on. It's roughly 300 pages. And it's quite a good read, but there are certain aspects I find completely mind-boggling. Like, they're doing the whole vague thing with high elves. The Phoenix King hasn't come out of his tower. They haven't said why. Teclis goes to go, what the hell are you doing? And he just comes back and goes, yeah, he's not coming out. And that's about it. So you don't really get anything from there. Mazdamundi says that it is the end of time and the great plan has failed and it's time for the Exodus, which some people are taking it to be he's the god of the lizard men. I don't know why people have got this god obsession going on at the minute. He's not, he's just a really old slan. But it does bring up a really bizarre point for me because this whole thing is based around bringing Nagash back to stop Archeon, because Archeon has united the demons and the warriors. Beastmen, I don't know if you really say united, but yeah, they're definitely moving out and attacking people, and everyone's pretty much at war. But the thing is, they've brought Nagash back to stop Archeon, and Archeon's done his best to stop Nagash, so they had this like face off during resummoning of Nagash to stop him from being as powerful as he could be. So he is kind of godish now. He's becoming a god. It's implied that his law, the law of undeath, will become one of the book laws. It will be in the BRB next edition, I imagine, if they carry on with the end times and don't rewind everything. He wants to get his stuff back. He needs to reconstitute things and he needs to do it fast because they're running out of time and the demons are kicking everyone's asses. The high elves are besieged. The high elves are being stupid and petty at the same time, so that doesn't help things. The lizard men are fighting like fury, but they're losing. But Nagash comes back and he does his all powerful resurrect all the dead thing. He goes to the Tomb Kings, defeats the Tomb Kings, brings them into the fold. So he's got one massive undead legion. But the thing is, this massive spell that he does that brings back all the undead, it should bring back all the undead. And from the sounds of that, if Nagash actually did that, he would stop the demons because all the dead Slann mage priests are mummified in the tombs. And I don't know if they're going to say it's because they're on a different continent or some such rubbish, but I've not actually seen a reason why we haven't got, dozens of mummified Slann mage priests waking up and going, oh yeah, I'm back. Which you'd have thought would give the lizard men a massive boost and not just, oh no, we're being attacked, oh, it's the end of time. It'd be like, ah, oh, yeah. Undead reinforcements have arrived. So yeah, that I find quite perplexing. And you could say it's because they're on a different continent, sorry. But I still find that a bit thin because there is actually a temple on the other side of the world that was separated when the continents divided. So there are lizard men on the other side of the world that are just really in hiding because that's their thing, they're avoiding things. But if all their dead Slann mage priests came back to life, I imagine the story might be quite a bit different. The Skaven are advancing and trying to kill everyone that they can, as you do when you're in a boon. They seem to be following the chaos theme. I mean, it's said that the Great Horned One came forward and killed a council member. It's because they were arguing and being petty, which I guess you can understand. But it means they need to fill in some of the blanks. And this is one of the things I've always said about Games Workshop. I don't think they like filling in the blanks and annoying people. So we'll really have to see about that one because it's hinted about what's happening, but we won't know if they are going to be officially part of Chaos or something else because you could say that they are working in line with Chaos to overtake the world as such. So, yeah, let's get back to the actual army as such. So chapter one of the book has five subheadings, four of them, 6 pages worth, special rules no one's probably ever going to use, because it's just tweaks and stuff that's undead-ish. The final one, obviously, page 14, Law of Undeath. This is probably something that a lot of people might want to listen to this for, I suppose. Basically, the Law of Undeath can be taken by any wizard. It's highlighted as to imply absolutely any wizard. And it is basically summoning undead. This is part of Nagash's new demi-powers, is the Law of Undeath. So you've got an array of spells, four of which are summoning spells, two augments, and one direct damage. So I'm just going to quickly describe each one and roughly their application afterwards. At the end of this entire thing, once I finish talking about the book, I'll do from the Skaven perspective. So, you got your default spell, the Grave Call, 12-inch range. You can summon 50 points worth of infantry from the Undead Legions as designated on page 20, which I'm sorry you'll have to wait till later to find out what you can actually summon. Right. But you can boost it, so you can have 50, 100 or 150 points. But the casting values are 9, 14 and 16. So it's not really cheap, unlike a lot of BRB decks where the default spell you can potentially one dice. There's no way you can one dice this. Well, maybe with level 4, but that's it. The actual chances of you actually summoning worthwhile stuff is limited on one dice. You're going to have to commit to throwing dice at this deck if you want to use this deck. Next one, spell 1, Breath of Darkness. This is an augment. Targets friendly undead within 12 inches of the caster immediately regains wounds, so basically raise dead as resurrecting fallen warriors. It can also make a movement if they have not been engaged in close combat, as in a remaining submoon phase. So you're normal, they can move, they can't charge, basically. But that, there's no restriction on it. It says they can make a movement, so potentially if you cast it on a flyer, that's quite a big movement. As you'll see later on, there's some other minor tweaks that are quite effective for these things, like being able to march. Every time you cast a spell, you get to add certain counters as the lore attribute. So what these do is they allow you to boost the amount of points that you are summoning. So the entire lore attribute is dedicated to boosting your summons. Which can be good, as you'll probably realise in a minute. Hand of Dust is the second one, that is an augment spell. The wizard can choose to swap his attack for a single attack that, if hits, deals d6 wounds with no armor saves allowed. You immediately gain d6 raised dead counters if they suffer. If they kill the character that they were fighting. Now, that, for undead, I don't think is a particularly good spell. But for Skaven, for a seer and a bell, then I think that's actually going to be generally alright, because when you do get to combat, you tend to make sure he's got Fencer Blades on him anyway to make sure he's alright. So if you've got Fencer Blades and you're on a bell and your weapon skill 10, you should be hitting him on 3s, automatically wounding them and causing d6 wounds. So 3s to hit, d6 wounds, potentially dead, take him off. So yeah, that has good application, and that only needs a 7. So that is really easy to cast. Soul Stealer, another one, 12-inch range. You roll 2d6 plus 2. For every point you exceed the target's leadership, it suffers a wound with no armor saves allowed. It's kind of the usual undead leadership stuff. You immediately gain d3 counters for your raised deading. Each counter, by the way, adds 10 points worth of summoning value. So, say you use three counters on the Grave Call, that would be 80 points worth of stuff. The interesting thing with this is, because they are counters which are your lore attribute, you cast the spell, then you add the lore attribute, so then you decide how many counters you want to add. So it is completely up to you. So say you've got like seven counters and you're about to cast a spell. You two dice it, you irresistible force it. Well, you might have something horrendous happen. So you can use all your counters then on one thing. There's nothing here that says that there's a maximum number of counters you can apply to a spell. So you could potentially go mental and just put them all on one spell. I don't know if you can store them. See, friendly wizard can use to cast on any subsequent summoning spell. See, this is another thing. This is something that really needs to be in the FAQ. Can you save them from one phase to your next phase so you've got more tokens, or should you discard them at the end of your turn? Because no other magic lore attribute really works like this, aside from perhaps the Wood Elves' high magic attribute, which is auto wound absorption tokens, but that's very clear that you just add a token to the unit and that token only comes off when that unit suffers a wound. So you could be seeing a move towards things happening that stack over the course of the game, in which case you could potentially save a load of tokens till you really need them and summon a massive unit or a really expensive thing. You've got your usual restrictions that they have to be summoned at least an inch away, they can't be near buildings, impassable, you know, they can face any direction, any legal formation, don't need to deploy in the caster's line of sight or forward arc. You can't do dodgy tactics like speed bumping by making them a one column unit. If you have five models, you must deploy them five wide. So it's there's that kind of stipulation. So it's just the general, can the raised dead be passed on to the next magic phase? It's very dubious, and it's not the only dubious thing I think you'll find as I go through the book. So the Abyss Swarms is summoning again, but rather than infantry this time, it's 12 inch. You can summon War Beast Swarms up to 75 points, or you can cast it to upgrade value, and you can summon Monstrous Beasts. So yeah. And that's 75 points worth or 150 points worth cast on a 10 or a 16 with a range of 12. So yeah, it's really what do you want to summon and when do you want to summon it. Obviously, with there being four summoning spells, if you get them all, it's going to be quite hard to stop them all, but also you will require a hell of a lot of dice to actually cast them all. So I don't know, it's kind of iffy as to how good the deck is. Till we've tried it and played it, I imagine it's going to be quite awkward to predict what's actually going to happen. But I have some rough ideas, but we'll talk about that later. The Harbinger, number 5. Again, summoning, range 12 inch. The caster summons a single character worth up to 65 points selected from the Undead Legion army list per page 20 of this book. You can instead summon a single monster, chariot, or war machine up to 200 points on a 24 plus. Now, this one is fraught with ifs, buts, and maybes. Can you summon something and shoot it in the shooting phase? Can you summon a rock lobber and it fire in the immediate shooting phase afterwards? It's got some minor issues. It sounds cool, and from a saving perspective, I mean, a lot of people said to me, what would you do with that? And the first thing that comes to mind with me is I would summon a wraith to stick in front of a unit and chaff block someone. 50-point character from the VC book. There you go. Chaff block. Right. Number six, the Dark Rider. 16 plus. Summoning. 12 inch. You can summon a single cavalry unit, monstrous cavalry or chariot worth up to 150 points. As per page 20, blah blah. Right, so yes, you can see there's four summoning. It is very dependent on what page 20 of this book actually says. It's got varying applications, but the key thing is none of these spells are cheap to cast. Which brings us to the Undead Legion's special rules, page 18 of the new book. Basically, this just outlines the changes in rules for these undead as opposed to normal undead. You don't use the normal rules from those books, you use the rules from this book combined with the characters and items and units from those books. So, first off, undead units within 12 inch of the new general can march. That is big for one army and not for another, because Tomb Kings being within 12 inches of general generally didn't mean squat. Now it means you can march, which is a significant difference. The Undead Battle Standard is exactly the same generally. You suffer one less unstable than you normally would. For those of you that aren't familiar with Undead, for whatever you beat them in combat, that's how much they lose combat by. So if you beat them by five, they take five wounds automatically. So that's just how it is. But what actually happens in this instance is you'd take one less. There are other things that will stack with this, as you'll probably know later on as we go through it. Animated constructs have special rules. They have an armor of five up. In addition, they suffer one less wound normally. So already you see animated constructs and being near the BSB, that's two less wounds. This is specifically stated as being accumulative with other effects. So there are certain things to put together. Units with the Arrow of Sapphire special rule never count bonuses or penalties to hit when shooting regardless. So much like Wood Elves, you've got arrows, but unlike Wood Elves, these can only ever hit on a 5 up. It's bad. When you consider the combinations, you can now add archers, caskets, stone throwers to Blender Vampire Lords. This is quite a nasty combination that you can come up with. I imagine it won't take long before we start seeing things like that. Right. That brings us to the infamous page 20. So I'll just give a very quick readout as to what actually is available and not available for those of you that haven't actually bought the book. So your lords, you've got Nagash, Manfred von Kastein, Archon the Black, Nefrati, Krell, Vlad von Kastein, your standard vampire lord, your master necromancer, Stroggy Grug King, High Queen Khaleedi, Tomb King, High Lich Priest, and then heroes. You've got vampires, necromancers, white kings, Khaine Wraiths, tomb banshees, Prince Apophis, tomb prince, tomb herald, lich priest, and necrotic. For core, you've got zombies, skeleton warriors, VC, crypt ghouls, dire wolves, skeleton warriors, skeleton archers, skeleton horsemen archers, skeleton chariots. In special, you've got the Corpse Guard, Graveguard, Black Knights, Crypt Horrors, Fellbat, Bat Swarms, Spirit Host, X-Rays, Vanguard, Tomb King, Necrocopic Knights, Tomb Scorpions, Yashamti, Tomb Swarms, Carrion, Khemri War Things, Stalkers, Harbringers. And then rare, you've got Vargulf, Blood Knights, Khaine Wraiths, Black Coach, Terrorgeist, Mortis Engine, Colossus, Hero Titan, Necrothink, Screaming Skull Catapult, Casket Skulls, and one of the new units, Morgost Atati. So yeah, there is an insane number of units to choose from, basically to make the vast majority of Tomb King and Vampire armies completely acceptable within this. You can basically just pick up the book and start using this instead of your standard army. So, yeah. What is that really going to change? Well, for Tomb Kings, a hell of a lot. It gives you access to some good stuff to back up your shooty stuff. There's also one other minor point, which by lack of not being there, you have to still remember, there is no mention of Undead Crumble when your general dies. It's not there anymore, it's just gone. So, and as explained by the story, the winds of magic now are that strong that it's believed that sustaining undead legions is very easy from very far distances. So you don't have the "I'm just going to kill your general and hope that that wins me the game" maneuver anymore. Every army must have a general. They've still got that, so you've got to have one. But that is it, really. He's just a puppet. So you can have a Blender Lord now and just go mental with him if you wanted, because if he dies, meh, what difference does it make? So you've still got the general army rules. You've got to have a general, you've got to have a minimum of 3 units. You can spend 50% on lords, you can spend 50% on heroes, you must spend 25% on core. The other restrictions are the same: 50% special, 25% rare. So I don't even really know why they've given such vast availability for characters. And the grand limit options are still exactly the same. So once you go over 3k, it just doubles. But other than that, it is almost exactly the same. There's a couple of special characters in the book. On page 24, you've got Nagash with all his special powers, and he's got extra bonuses, and he's a level 5 wizard, and he knows loads of magical spells, and he can store power dice, etc. So yeah, he does make the lore of undeath far easier to cast, but he's 1,000 points. Then you've got Montred von Castellan, Archon the Black, Neferata, Krell, Vlad von Castellan. Now you've got these Morghast, Harbringers, and Archai. The Harbringers are a special choice, which are a minimum unit size of 2, so you've got to spend at least 160 points. They've got 2 hand weapons, heavy armour. Yeah, they're basically kind of like a Croxigor, somewhat. So movement 6, weapon skill 5, strength toughness 5, 4 wounds, initiative 4, attacks 3, leadership 10. The silly thing with these for me is they're not giving them any weaknesses. They're an average across the board thing. They're initiative 4, so their initiative isn't even that bad. They've got leadership 10, so you can't snipe them with death magic or anything like that. They've got heavy armour, so they've got 4 attacks with the additional hand weapon. They hover, have killing blow, undead, and cause terror. These are Herald of the Accused One special rules, which means that all friendlies within 12 inch suffer 1 less wound than would normally do due to unstable, in addition to any other modifiers. So there's a definite stacking process going on here. If you have a unit of Harbringers, it adds to whatever else you've got. So the Archai are very similar, but rather than having 2 hand weapons, they've got a halberd. They've got Ebon Wrath armor, which is a 4-up save rather than 5-up. Hover, killing blow, terror, undead, exactly the same. 10 points more, minimum unit size 2. And again, in addition, they will add 1, 2, not crumbling. So you've already got your general, your BSB. If you have a unit of each of these, that's another 2. So if you have 4 of these different units behind a Titan, for example, which is a constructs, it crumbles one less anyway. That's five less crumble. That basically means it's not going to die. There are some cheesy combinations you can come up with if you look at it. And it's an interesting one. It'd be interesting to see what the lists come out with. But there's some issues with wording. It's like, can you take two BSBs? It just says what characters you can have. And it doesn't say you can't have more than one. So, you know, you're going to get these weird things come up. And now that they reduce crumble, you're going to get people groaning about it. Because it specifically says it reduces crumble. And most of these reduce crumble things stack. If not all. In fact, I'm not sure I've seen one that says it doesn't. Undead battle standard. In addition to normal rules, the army battle standard. Friendly unit within 12 inch special rules. One less wound than normally would as a result of instability. So there's room in there to take a Vampire Count's battle standard and a Tomb King's battle standard. Now, I'm not saying it's right, but you know, this is this is the problems with GW not thinking some things through. The irritating thing is, if they'd just shoved all these unit entries in this book, if they'd have made it 20 pages longer or something, you could have had all this stuff in here so that it was nailed down and there was no arguing. But they've left it in a way that there's some dubious wordings to things. There's also an entry for Valen and Crom the Conqueror. There's nothing really to write home about, I don't think. I don't know, some really overpriced characters. Valen doesn't seem that awesome, and he's 330 points. Crom, yeah, same again. He's got some slightly impressive stats, but he's 230 points, and he's just a dude on foot. Who takes warriors on foot? That's just unheard of. Then you've got a variety of Snarik-based missions based on current events going off with and around the events of the end time. There are loads of them. I'm literally still scrolling through the book. So if you like playing ambush missions and historical event reruns, it's all pretty reasonably done out, and then there's a lot of it all from pages 85 to 49. So 49 to 85, all scenario based. And that is basically it. So all you really get is a list of what you can and cannot use. The lore of Undeath and the special characters, and one page with Herald of the Accused special and rare options. The models just irritate me somewhat. They've got giant freaking stupid halberds. Where the hell did they get those weapons from? You're not seriously telling me that they sat and made their own weapons, because one, why would they? Their hand is bigger than anyone's head. You do not need a halberd, you pick them up by the head and squeeze. There you go, dead person that you're trying to kill. Job's a good one. Yeah, 20-foot long halberds are just ridiculous. So, yes, Nagash makes the magic far easier to use, far simpler. But from a Skaven perspective, I think the Lore of Undeath will actually do some things for us, if it's ever allowed at tournaments. The thing is, this is officially marked as an expansion, so the chances of it being accepted at any tournament scene is slim. That being said, however, on the 2nd of November, the Outpost Sheffield, there is a tournament going on, and it is probably going to allow Lore of Undeath as it goes. So, yeah, that should be interesting. So from a Skaven point of view, I mean, there's no reason why you couldn't put a warlock and a seer in and take Lore of Undeath. It's only the same principle of maxing out any deck, really. It's only 400 points, maybe with a couple of items, give or take. I think if you got the right spells on a seer, it could be quite good. And the fact that you can default to raise is pretty good. My dubious things come in is, can you summon something and then it can shoot? You know, like a catapult. Or can you summon a casket of souls and then use that in the magic phase? There's some dubious issues, I think, that'll gonna happen. Nagash triples the ranges and the summoning values, so Nagash can summon a Terragash right next to where he wants to scream in the shooting phase, which might help him survive cannons. It might be the only thing that helps him survive cannons because it's huge, huge and ridiculous. But I think summoning chaff to block stuff up that's going to pound through your saves and make another layer of defense. I mean, in the ETC, your chaff is comped. You can only take like 5, 6 units of chaff throughout the whole different chaff units that Skaven use. So, adding zombies to your army is gonna just change everything about that. But alternatively, there's other things. Characters, if this is going to be the trend, if we are going to see combined stat lines and a single line for things like dudes on dragons with 8 wounds, with 1 up save and 4 up ward that are really hard to shift, you're going to end up killing things through other means. Like, if you had raise, you could summon a unit of undead. If you have augment spells and stuff to keep things going, you can keep going forever. All you need to do is run into a dragon, challenge your unit champion, your champion dies. Next turn, well, your turn, sorry, you summon a unit of undead directly behind it. In your next turn, you charge said unit into rear of target, which is still bogged down because all he managed to do is kill a champion, so he still probably lost combat anyway. And you can have 3 ranks of charge a rear. You can feed him a warlock for 2 wounds again. It's just not going to be very good for any dude in a dragon. And I think Lore of Undeath will help with things like that. Also, I definitely think the Hand of Dust is a good choice for anyone who's using a blade to keep your weapon skill high so you don't get hit much. I mean, you just don't want to hit at all. Sorry, you don't want to wound at all. So your weapon skill 10 versus whatever, chances are you're hitting on a 3. If you hit, they're auto wounded. D6 wounds, no save, dead. So they'll have a ward save. Will MR count against it? I guess it's happening in Magic Phase, so they probably will, so that's really subjective against what you're fighting, because some people take MR and some people don't. But generally speaking, you've got snipe spell, raise spell, kill spell, and then 4 summons. So yeah, it really just comes down to what you're going to summon, where you're going to summon it. With the massive list of units available, you can summon stuff to block off things. I mean, there is no reason why you have to summon zombies. You can summon other things. It just states that it needs to be infantry, or it must be this, it must be that. So, you know, you can summon skeletons with killing blow, stuff like that if you're fighting knights. Or you can summon the bats that reduce your enemy to having always strikes last. Or you can summon spirit hosts that are Ephril or the Wraith character. I mean, the ultimate make or take is you can summon not a vampire, a basic necromancer. And yeah, that is just filth, really, because then you're adding more wizards to get more magic. Or it could just be a sacrifice if you need someone. But the other thing is, if you're summoning characters, What happens? Can the character go in one of your units, being that you are not unstable, unbreakable? If he does go in your unit, do you take a separate test for him? Does he have to see if he's dead when he crumbles? You know? Or does he flee with the unit? I mean, it's something that I don't know how you'd work out. Do vampires crumble in a unit of clan rats? It's a strange one. Though I'm guessing you wouldn't if you had a Blender Lord in there, but that's highly unlikely that you'd be able to do anything like that. But yeah, you'd definitely be able to get a Necromancer in there. So there are quite an array of things you could do and try and pull off. Like Corpse Cats can bubble special abilities. You could do that. I can't remember what it does. I just remember that it has a bubble special ability. I might have to gry out my other books. But yeah, there's just a vast array of different combinations and ideas, and you're just going to have to go through and look at them all and try and figure out what you can and cannot do. But I think it's just going to open up chaff.com. I've always thought that the Skyra shooting army of death days were back on the rise again, and this book definitely helps that, because you can just chaff shoot. Oh, I'll raise 20 zombies then block you off for a little bit longer. It's all just about buying a bit more time to fire at you while your main stuff gets away. So yeah, that's generally it for the Nagash book. It's worth a read. It's a very interesting book. I'll be interested to see what the second End Times is, if and when it comes out. There's lots of ums and ahs about we're going to get two more, but I don't know. I've heard between 2 and 5 different titles for what the next End Time Nagash will be, so it's a little hard to know what is going to happen or if it's actually going to happen. But yeah, that is generally what's expected. Another elf book, and then another book of some description, probably a vastly chaos related one. Hopefully we'll get some idea of what's going to happen with the Skaven. I don't think that the legions are going to be a particular issue for Skaven as they are now. I think stacking anti-crumble is going to be irritating, and some people saying that they can take 2 BSBs is going to be irritating. But I'm not really sure if there's an ironclad way of telling me you can't, because some of the wording is just not that good. Right, so I'm going to take a quick break. In case you can't tell, I really need a drink, so I'll probably stick in a relatively Nagashi book song. And I definitely advise you to buy it if you're interested. Just don't expect massive things from it. It's mostly fluff, so if you like reading about undead and what's happening in the Warhammer world, then it's a good read, but don't set your expectations too high like some people have.
No!
And I'm back. Water, nectar of life for the living. So, some time ago, I went to the Yorkshire Bash at the end of August. I had a Skaven off at the start of the game. It was Skaven versus Skaven, the grand uncasing of my Skaven coming out of retirement from the tournament scene. And it was an interesting one because they got an objective-based mission scenario. And I was being pillocked that if I lost the game that I would be fired from Chief Skaven because apparently I'm King Rat, and if I do then I've just betrayed all my kin. So you got secret objectives which I have to play, and I played the obvious one, kill the enemy general, because it's everything to do that with Skaven, and he had the dude on the bell. So yeah, I was definitely going to go for that one with two cannons on my list. You also had table quarters and killing more enemy characters, and you lose, which I gotta say it was a real tough one because he had four characters and I had nine. I practiced this one twice before the tournament and it was an absolute nightmare trying not to lose your characters. So yeah, I got pretty lucky with that one. They also had you have to get fortitude in their deployment zone and not have his fortitude in your deployment zone, but it pretty much turned into a massive smash fest. He ran at me, I ran at him. The dude with the fell blade stepped up and killed the bell from under the seer, and I proceeded to run down his unit. But literally, I turned to the table next to us and went, what turn are you guys on? It's like, oh, we've just turned six. This was the start of our turn three, because we've literally spent an hour taking models off. The dead pile was just horrendous, because everyone was laughing about it. Because it wasn't using the 20-0 system, where you've got to lose less points than your opponent to get a good ratio. It was just purely victory points. I was going mad. There was a massive combat. His general's unit was in it, my general's unit was in it, and another unit was in it. And I just needed to break his general, so I just plagued it. And because I plagued it, and I'd got 80-odd models involved, and he'd only got 40, he let me have it. But it did actually swing the battle. It did break his unit, because I broke his steadfast. But I did kill, like, 50 of my own dudes between both units. But I killed enough of his that he'd got less ranks than me at the end, which is all that really mattered. Because fortunately, I decimated only one unit, and not both evenly. But, you know, those are the dice. So, yeah, that propelled me onto table one with 4,812 victory points, nearing the cap. And then I had to play Filthy Ogalist, which had a giant gut star. And I suppose this was, I don't know, just reward, perhaps. Really. As Filth put it, I peaked too soon by annihilating the Skaven, even though he was pushing me to do it. And what basically happened was, he got turn one, I put Storm Banner on, he rolled two four-ups for his cannons, both of his cannons fired and removed both of my cannons. Turn two, the Storm Banner was still on, he rolled two four-ups, both of his cannons removed both of my Doom Wheels. You can see how this is going already. When he got to about 20 inches away, he used the Hell Heart, rolled a six, hit my wizards, and I had two horrendous miscasts in a level one fall down a hole, which pretty much lost me the game from there on. But it probably was due, because I've not really lost to ogres at all, really, in eighth. So this is my first loss with Skaven against ogres. So it was pretty brutal, but That's the Skaven way. When it doesn't work, it just doesn't work. And I didn't get a chance to fire anything. And I just got cannoned off, as you do when you're versus heat-seeking ogre cannons of death. And that put me on a fairly middle table at that point. I was on table one for the first game, table one for the second game. And then I was on table... Oh, I've got it up here. Table five. For game three against the High Elf list, which was rather interesting, mostly monster based. It actually was really irritating playing the game, because some pet peeves that were going on, I'm not going to mention anything just for politeness. Erin, stop it! That's my dog trying to destroy the settee. I've just got a puppy. But yes, it was a pretty good event overall. The High Elf game in the end was really fun, actually, because there was just weird stuff going on. I had Stormbanner team, he'd got dragons, phoenixes and all sorts, and they couldn't fly, so they were hopping across the board. And then when the Stormbanner actually ended, I cast Howling Warp Gales and went, yeah, you carry on hopping. And I managed to kill his general on this Moon Dragon, Star Dragon, whatever it is. And yeah, it was an interesting combination. Some things went pretty tits up, like I threw the blast orb at something, rolled a misfire, put it over my warlock's head. How often does it actually kill him? I was also using him as a chaff block at the time, so I rolled 6 and killed the warlock as well, and I was like, oh, he's not chaff blocking anymore. Oh god, that's irritating. So yeah, that was a pretty up and down moment, really. But yeah, good fun. Outpost events usually are pretty sporting, pretty good. You do get the occasional whacker. There were some pretty heated games going on, but I think some games were pretty close, so they were getting a bit tense and arguing about rules, but yeah, see the point for any of that. It was an awesome game. I had the first game, Skaven, against Michael Crossley. I think it was his first time with Skaven as well, he said. But yeah, he did fairly alright, and yeah, he did some crazy stuff in his second game, because he drew Isles for his second game, and he rolled a Doomwheel up against a dragon and shot the dragon out from under the prince, didn't kill the prince, and then this is when he revealed that he took 13th on the off chance that he shot a dragon out from underneath a character, and then he did 6 dice that character to kill him. Which I gave him points for insanity, because that's like massive overkill there, just to try and kill a lord, really. But I suppose elf lords are a bit evil, really. So yeah, that was the end of the tournament. I placed about 11th out of 24, 25. Good events at the Outpost usually are. Different compacts vary quite a lot, and you do get quite a different crowd of people. It's not the same people every time, so I think that in itself makes it more interesting, because playing the same people all the time can get really repetitive. I mean, it's the reason you go to these events, isn't it? If you're alright playing local friends, then you just play them all the time, so you know, you've got to have a bit of variation just to spice things up a bit. I think the list performed okay. I think on the third game I just went a bit crazy. I should have just took 13s against Hyles, and for some reason I didn't, and I didn't think about it, and he had a massive block of Phoenix Guard and with heavy armor, and then a 4-up ward that they needed 13th enough, because they were just irritating. Right, so that's really the end of my tournament. I thought it was pretty good. So, some news about the site. It's been a bit delayed for quite a while, because I've had a rather lengthy argument with my web host regarding web traffic. Basically, the last couple of pods have been rather popular, so popular that I've been stuck with a rather hefty fine for bandwidth usage that I shouldn't be paying, which I have a copy of my contract says I shouldn't be paying. It says that I have unlimited access, but then it goes on to say it that this does not apply for certain things, but it doesn't specify what said things are, only that I should inquire about it, which wouldn't stand up in any freaking court of law. So it's just bullshit, basically. And they're basically just trying to squeeze me for more money, so I have finally managed to sort out a host that's reliable. I've used them in the past, so I know they're not going to try and screw me. I just moved away from them because they're one of these servers where you do get a good deal, but it's because you've got to do everything yourself. So I've had to set up the server itself to then turn it into a web server. Not like with 1&1, who were my previous ones, which have tried to crap on me from a great height, where you can just sign an account up, create a folder on the server, and start dropping your web files on there, and you're done. No, there's none of that. Yeah, I've got to configure the server, I've got to install PHP, MySQL, PDO, everything else, and get it all set up and functioning myself. So I have got it now, so I can resume trying to push for changes. I didn't want to change the layouts because the one I'm developing is rather bandwidth intensive, so it would use more bandwidth, and then be using it as an excuse to try and bar up the expenses. It's not really worth arguing with them over the cost now that I've rung them and told them to shove it. So I'll be ending my contract with them because it's just a monthly rolling contract, and I'll be moving once I've fully developed this server and got it set up and securely done. Everything should be going on there, and then it should be shortlist mocked over. So that is the main reason for the bulk of the delays. I'm fed up to the back teeth of 1&1 trying to stealth charge me whenever I use web services on their web services package. It's irony, I suppose, but some of these American companies are awesome sometimes when you deal with them. They're twisted logic. So I'm really looking forward to getting it all set up. And it is already half set up practically. I've been slogging away at it, but these things take time, and as such, it's a bit soul-consuming. So if you've got any questions or comments, or you want to know more about the Nagash book, feel free to drop us a message or leave a reply, and I'll be more than happy to answer questions for anything you might have. It's an interesting book. I can't wait to see what the other books turn out like. And we'll just have to grit his teeth that they don't try and ruin it by being weird. So fingers crossed for that one. Anyway, if you're still listening, thank you very much, and I'll see you next time. All right. Cheers. Bye.